When I turned my life around and I discovered my purpose, my world changed. From believing that the best I could be was a bus driver, I literally remember looking up into the sky and thinking to myself, I can do anything I want to do. And believing it in my heart of hearts. Then I asked myself the question, what do you want to do? And I thought to myself, there are so many people like me. I never knew it before, but there are so many people like me who are living a life they don't want to be living because they don't feel there's any other way.
All right. Welcome back, everyone, to Lost and Searching, previously known as the Mindful Leader podcast. Here in season two, we are focusing on the theme of stress and breakdowns. And today we're speaking with actually an old friend of mine, a man named Jeffrey Wotherspoon. And Jeffrey and I actually met several years ago when I was actually on a youth advisory board for a charity, and he was a facilitator for us, and I always really liked his energy. And then after years of having not spoken to each other, we caught up quite recently, and it really struck me that his story would work really well for the kind of message we're trying to deliver on this podcast. So today we're going to be listening to him kind of share his story of various different struggles and issues with us, and how he started to overcome and transform those feelings. And it actually really personally resonates with me a lot, because he talks to us a lot about how he felt like the world was kind of saying no to him in a lot of ways, but he kept going and eventually grew to be someone who has supported a lot of people and a lot of young people over time. So I think today's episodes can be really relevant to everything this podcast is about. Now, quickly, before we get started, I wanted to let you know that if you enjoy the show, I could really use your help right now. I'm running a giveaway where if you fill out a survey that I'm running, you're in with a chance to win, and you can also leave questions or comments for our guests for future episodes. So it would help me out immensely. There's more about that in the description. Without further ado, let's get into it.
Self-sabotage is our conscious and our subconscious resisting, you know, the conflict between the conscious and the subconscious, and it's that resistance that we are trying to understand and overcome.
How people become aware of how their minds work. What are their default settings? Do they tend to be overly optimistic or overly pessimistic?
All of us have the same regrets when we die. All of us have pretty much the same regrets. Why didn't I live truer to my own purpose? Why was I swayed by other people's ideas of what I should do?
Many leaders feel that they have to be perceived as bold and strong and courageous. And there's almost this thought that a lot of people have in which they feel they can't show others that they're weak. But at the end of the day, we're all human beings.
All right, Jeffrey. Thanks so much for joining me this morning, man. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Seven. And yeah, thank you for having me on. Pleasure to be speaking to you.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for coming on with me, man. I'm really kind of both excited and in a way humbled to kind of hear your story, because your story is one that we haven't quite heard on the podcast before, right? It's got a lot of kind of unique elements to it. And I'm just really excited for everyone to hear about you and learn about some of the transformations you've gone through. So I think to get us started off the back of that, just tell us a little bit about kind of who you are and your story.
Yeah. So who I am. So I'm Jeffrey. I'm a husband. Been married 3.5 years now, or coming up to 3.5 years. Grew up in London. I now live in the Green, Kent. I've got 2 younger sisters and a mother whom I love very much, as well as, you know, my wider family and my in-laws. And yeah, professionally, I'm an executive coach. I'm a life coach as well. I'm a trainer and a conflict resolution specialist. And that more or less sums up what I do day to day. And when you say my story, you mean
what made you who you are now, I guess? Yeah. Like, what is the life that led you down the path to even answering the question the way that you did? Because something I love about what you've just said is I don't think anyone so far, when I've asked them who are you, has told me, well, I I'm playing, you know, I have all these roles and these people that I love, and that's a core part of who I am. So even that answer has been unique so far.
Okay.
So yeah, what kind of brought you to where you are now?
Yeah, that's a big question, but yeah. I'll go where my mind takes me.
Good, cool.
So where, you know, what brought me to where I am? So if I go really early on, being younger, right? Let's say when I was just a young lad. I remember my mum saying to me, you know, probably when I was around 10 years old, what do you want to be? And I said, I want to be a footballer. And she was like, no, don't do that. Be a doctor or a lawyer. And I was like, I want to be a footballer. And, you know, we had that whole conversation, but I had it, my mum had it in her head. She wants me to be a doctor and lawyer. And obviously to make my mum feel happy at the time, just a little bit proud, I'd say, yes, you know, I want to be a doctor or lawyer. Knowing that I didn't want to be a doctor or lawyer. And really what I realized, even looking back, is in my mind, the doctors were sort of Asian and the lawyers were white. And that was my reference point. So I was like, how can I be a doctor or lawyer? Because they don't look like me. I don't know any doctors and lawyers that look like me. And that carried on through my upbringing. So, you know, at the time, my mum worked a job where she got paid by the hour. We were living with my, you know, my sister's dad was in the picture. He was also getting paid by the hour. All of my friends, their parents got paid by the hour. I mean, we lived in sort of council estates and council blocks. So life to me was, in a sense, poverty wouldn't be the right word, but I wouldn't necessarily say was comfortable. You know, money didn't seem to be something me or people around me had. And those were the narratives I heard. Plus, I used to see my mom work a lot. And then, you know, she used to work. She always used to shout at me saying, I'm working 16 hours on a Monday so I can pay for you to go to Saturday school. I'm like, bloody hell, who wants to go to Saturday school? You know, don't work those 16 hours. Let me, you know, give me the money.
Yeah.
I could use it. So you know, I was of the mindset that, look, money isn't for people like me. And how that links to my story is I grew up with that mindset. And, you know, I think people have different personalities. And I am... I would say I'm not necessarily out there, but I'm, you know, I would describe myself as a leader, and not necessarily in the sense where I'm maybe leading people as such, but I think if I'm somewhere, I can be noticed, if that makes sense. It's like my personality, you know. Yeah.
Okay.
So I think what that meant is, just the lifestyle and maybe the people that hung around growing up, not having money wasn't really an option because of, let's say, a status or reputation that I had growing up. And therefore, I had to make money some way, somehow. And, you know, not being old enough to work, you find ways to make money. So, you know, when I was very younger, I used to steal because, you know, I'm talking about 10 years old and sort of around that age, because you don't think about making money at that time. When I got to secondary school and was exposed to other things, I found out there's other ways to get things rather than stealing them. So I kind of ventured into that. And what that did is it just took me away from education. In terms of my football aspirations, that wasn't necessarily supported by my mum and stuff.
Okay.
So that was never going to happen. And, you know, I didn't, you know, looking back now, I didn't necessarily understand education and how to learn how to revise. So for me, I just used to try my hardest. You know, I go to my lessons. I'm not necessarily paying attention that much. And then obviously exams and stuff come around and you're meant to revise. But I didn't know how to revise. And I didn't know that I didn't know how to revise. It wasn't a concept for me until I went to college. So I just really used to obviously just turn up and try my best. And, you know, fortunately, I would pass, i.e. get a C and a B. Well, no. Yeah, I did actually get Bs in my GCSE. But, you know, that's as far as it went. So education didn't seem like a viable route for me, particularly as I wasn't achieving in my mind, right? So I had to think about life and what does life mean for me and who do I want to be in life? And obviously I wanted to have money in life, not even to be rich, just to have money, to not have to struggle, to be hopefully able to drive a nice car and go on a holiday and, you know, buy some nice clothes, etc. So just simple stuff, really. And to be honest, I didn't see myself working. Not because I didn't want to. I would have happily worked, but I didn't see myself ever working for a salary, i.e. a job where you go and you know this is how much you're getting a year. And the reason is I didn't know anyone who had that or who did that.
Yeah. So there were lots of like lots of routes in life that you saw other people taking, and all of them felt kind of closed to you. None of them felt like viable options for you, education, kind of normal work and things like that. And did you notice like some of those leadership qualities when you were young, or is that more in like a on reflection you noticed that that was kind of the case?
I didn't notice it when I was young in the terms of leadership. I just noticed that, for example, you could be popular. I was popular, and partly that was due to football. Partly that was due to being a bit naughty. Partly that was due to like strong, being, you know, fighting and being a bit risky in my behavior, as I say. So I from a young age, I started to hang around older people, and that just wasn't a good influence for me. And of course, I was getting reinforcement for them. So then that reinforced the negative behavior, which then, you know, led me to continue down that cycle. And that's kind of what life looked like for me.
Okay. And how did that shape as you got into your kind of young adult years, right? So obviously we started with childhood, and all of it starts with childhood, but those, like you said, instilled certain types of mindsets. How did those mindsets evolve, or what kinds of, you know, decisions did that cause you to make as you kind of grew up and became a young adult and those mindsets came with you?
I would say by the time I was 13, which is a young teen, I was probably involved in a lot of things I shouldn't have been involved in for that age. You know, some of the things I was involved in and doing, people usually do older, maybe let's say 15 and 16. But I already had that influence. So I moved from South London to East London. In hindsight, that was amazing for my life. The group that I used to be with, each and every one of them is in a situation. Some have been deported. Some are serving life in prison, and some are in and out of prison. There was there was one of them that he was actually the oldest one, funnily enough. And I randomly saw him in Fort Park one day, and he just looked like a normal dude. So I don't really know what's going on with his life, but I know that the other people, I mean, they are not living a life I would be proud of. So I realized moving was really beneficial. But obviously I had a particular approach to life. So I moved to East London and more or less continued, but in a different way. And I didn't have the solid group in the same way. So my focus was more money. And what that meant growing up into sort of adulthood is I did go to college because, as I say, I passed my GCSEs. So that's just a natural progressive step, right? And then the hope was university after that. But that wasn't really my focus. It was, again, just making money. And what happened is... I actually really muffed up my first year of university. My first year of college. I didn't do well at all, apart from in psychology. And that's when I first learned about my gifting and my interest in psychology. So, you know, and as I say, I didn't do well because I just didn't really understand what was going on. Like, I did media. I chose my subjects at random, by the way. So, you know, there was a couple of older sort of extended family members. And I said to them, I basically met two family members in different occasions who went to university, and they told me they did psychology. So I thought, oh, do psychology then. So that was like my mindset. So I went to college, obviously, to choose my subjects. And I said, I want to do psychology. Then they said, you're supposed to pick three subjects. And I said, I really don't know what to pick. So help me. So then they said sociology is similar to psychology. Oh. I chose that. Then they said media is good as well. So I just chose that. So literally no rationale behind it. And then I just plagiarized my media kind of assignment. So I got like a U or E. So that really wasn't good in terms of going into second year. And what did happen is when we were second years, we obviously there were new first years and we had an issue. There was a problem which turned very serious and police got involved, et cetera, et cetera. And long story short, all my friends got kicked out of college apart from me. And again, that was another pivotal moment because then it enabled me to focus. And I was actually able to focus. And by this time, I understood what revision was. So I focused and I went to university. Now, I got to university and that was a bit of a culture shock for me. And I only went to Brunel University. So that's on the outskirts of London. So it's not actually miles away. But I just felt as though the people at university weren't like me. You know, they hadn't necessarily grown up in my environment or lived the type of life that I had lived. So I thought, this place isn't for me because I don't feel as though I can relate to anyone. Similarly, you know, I only really kind of started to learn in college, and university was independent learning. So that was just a huge struggle. The other thing I realized is I never read growing up. So going to university and having to read academic papers at the time felt impossible. And then, what happened is I'm at university. Basically, my friends are in London and I'm realizing that the bond isn't that strong because it's sort of out of sight, out of mind. And then I'm not feeling like I'm relating to anyone at university. And I don't feel like I can do the work either. And then, obviously, due to the life I did, I'd had some trouble with the police. So I had a record. So all of these factors are coming to mind for me in the first term of my university. And I thought, my life is not going to go well. You know?
Right. So, like, up to this point, it sounds like you've had situations where at any one point, you either felt like there wasn't a place for you, and that is very kind of lonely and isolating feeling, or you felt like this is kind of a place for me and I feel like I see myself represented in the people around me, but I don't actually like this lifestyle. There's all kinds of problems and it doesn't feel right for me. So it at any one point, there's either one of these two things going on and you're not happy with either of them. And it sounds, so those have issues in and of themselves, the loneliness, the it sounds like a little bit of feelings of isolation, confusion. I'm maybe even caused a little bit of depression, like where am I gonna go from here? And what I think I'd love to know from you is like what did that start to cause? At the time, did you feel like you could break out of that, or was it only when kind of more things started to happen and you got a little bit older that some change came from that?
Yeah. At the time, so I've had two life-changing moments in my life. And the first one was, you know, up until the point you've just asked me at university. And with all of those things compounding and feeling like my life is not going to go well and feeling out of control, because I didn't feel as though I chose any of this. Yeah, I felt as, and what came to me, the message that came to me and how I interpreted it is everyone is dealt cards in life.
Yeah.
And certain hands. And I've got this hand, which isn't the hand of living a good professional life. So I felt as though that's just my lot in life. So then I had the mindset I need to do the best of that. But there was no meaning or purpose behind it. I didn't want to live that life and I didn't want to do the best of it. So back to the isolation. First time in my life, I've really been isolated because I'm away from home and I'm literally by myself.
Yeah.
And I don't feel anyone can relate. And what that did is just bringing me almost a rage that I've never felt before up until that time.
Okay.
Plus, I was in a relationship at the time which wasn't going well, which just further compounded things. So what I just remember feeling is so angry and bitter at life and asking the question, why on earth am I here? I didn't ask to be here. I didn't ask to be born. And just look at how my life has turned out. And what's the point, you know, because I'm going to drop out of uni and what's the best job I can get? And I thought, you know, a job in a supermarket or McDonald's. And you know, the thing that really messed it up for me is I did apply for a job at McDonald's and I didn't get it. So that just sent other signals through my mind. I remember applying for the job at McDonald's and I went with a shirt and trousers. And my friend went to the same interview after college wearing a tracksuit trainers and a fake gold tooth. And he got the job and I didn't. And I thought, what on earth is going on here? So I just felt this life isn't where I want to be. And, you know, fortunately, suicide has never been a consideration for me. So I just made a decision to myself that, you know what, I'm going to drop out of uni at the end of the term. So I'll finish off the term. And I just thought, just go to all the raves and parties I can go to, just do whatever. And drop out at the end and just be a criminal in a sense. And I think what I was thinking at the time was just be the biggest drug dealer I can be, because, you know, I'll probably get a lot of money from that. And then if I go to prison, then I'll just be the worst person there. And that will end in one or two things, you know, potentially I'll die because someone might kill me. And then I won't have to deal with this pain anymore. And even if I do live that sort of life as a drug dealer and violence, etc., I might also die through that means. And that will be good as well. So that's kind of where I was in my life. And, you know, I've kind of just narrated it just as a sentence. But in terms of how it felt, oh my goodness, I can't describe it. But it was just a sense of loss, hopelessness, and not being able to see out of that.
It's like, I think, although I've never, I've never been through these specific experiences, it's kind of humbling in a way to hear, like, when you describe that you can't fully describe it. To me, I've had these moments where, like, it's almost like I'm in a very narrow tunnel, and the tunnel is only around my eyes. Obviously you can see me, but we're not recording the camera, but you can see me. It's like my hands are cupped around my eyes to the point where I'm crammed into this teeny tiny tunnel, and I can only go forward through this little tunnel, but it's so cramped. And I'm just trying to, like, push the walls of this tunnel out. It's like I've been forced into a little box and I can only see out of it one way. But I'm so full of, like, it's strange. It's like being full of anger and being empty at the same time. Like, you're full of something, but at the same time you're empty, and it doesn't make sense. It's this intense heaviness that, from my experience, seems to come from a combination of the loss of, like, the, like, almost like loss of yourself, like not having a strong sense of self for whatever reason, and not seeing a way out of it, right? So you're in a shitty situation and you don't see a way out of that situation. And I think something about that just makes a human being, like, bubble up. It's like, it's like the whole idea of your blood boiling. It's like you're, it's like you're boiling and the steam can't go anywhere, so you're just going to explode, you know?
That's exactly it, Seven. And, you know, you get it. And, you know, when I think back on it, I saw three options. My future is going to be in prison. I'm going to die early. Or I'm going to be somebody just who walks the street. You know, and I saw that happen. I saw some of the older people who, when I was younger, I used to think they were cool and stuff. And then just as I got older, they were still walking the streets. And I've literally saw those three as my possible futures. And of course, I didn't want any of them. And that's where the anger came from, because I'm like, why have I been given these cards? Why have I been given these cards that I don't want? And, you know, there's no other option. And that's why I said, well, if I've been given these cards, I'm not going to be the guy that walks on the street just aimlessly. And so it's going to be prison or death. And yeah, and, you know, I remember around that time seeing a bus go past, and there was an advertisement on it that said you can be a bus driver for 24K. And I thought to myself, look, if I drop out of uni and I try and get my driver's license, hopefully I can be a bus driver. And for me, that was my aspiration. But I was even still a little bit nervous because I didn't even know if I would be able to get my driver's license. And that's how much I thought I couldn't achieve. Yeah. And I was like, if I get 24K a year, firstly, that sounds like a hell of a lot of money to me right now. Because I don't think I know anyone who used to get 24K a year. And then if I sell drugs on the side, I mean, imagine how much money I'd have. And that was my only glimmer of hope for living a normal life.
It sounds like on one hand, you know, you were kind of, you had these were your thoughts. These were the stories you were telling yourself. These were the closest thing to an out that you saw. But at the same time, it sounds like you weren't like, and you said this in a way, you weren't happy with it. So you thought, this is what I need to do, or what if I'm lucky I'm gonna do. But at the same time, you weren't happy with it. And that's a scary feeling, isn't it? It sounds like it's almost I feel like if I had to deal with that, there would be a sense of fear there, because I'd be afraid of living a life I didn't want to live, or afraid of who I'd become as a result. Did you ever experience anything like that, or was it more the anger?
It was more the anger. You know, the point I got to, I haven't properly articulated, but it was a deep sense. It was rage. So I didn't care anymore.
Yeah.
As in, I made the decision and I no longer cared. I had nothing to lose and nothing to live for. And I didn't want to be here, so there was no more fear.
Yeah, okay. Okay, that makes sense. It's that moment of just intense rage where there's no room for anything else. I have felt those at small times before. And it makes me... on one hand, it does make me sad, really, really sad to hear when people are going through those times, because it's almost like it's hard to see anything else, right? Like you said, there's no room left for fear. There's no room left for a lot of things when you're in that state of mind. It is so overwhelming. It's like the idea that everything turns red. It really kind of does. For anyone who hasn't experienced that, it's this weird psychological thing seems to start to happen where your brain just stops taking in all kinds of information and you're just super focused on that rage, right? And it's an all-encompassing feeling, and it's just, I don't know how else to describe it than that. It's that idea of your blood boiling, like it really does feel like you're going to explode. So,
and to be honest, you described it brilliantly. You articulated it perfectly.
So let's then take a look at what changed, right? So there was that intense rage, and I know from experience that even with such intense rage, it can start to be transmuted and transformed a little bit, and you had some transformative times. So what changed for you that inevitably kind of took you away from this kind of path?
Yeah. So what changed? So I had that feeling, right? Around the first term of my university. And what began to happen after that is I began to meet people. And when I say meet people, in the halls I lived at university, I was on the ground floor and my window was always open. And what happened literally within a week was people that I knew as acquaintances would just come visit me randomly and talk to me. And everyone who spoke to me somehow the conversation would turn and they would start speaking to me about God and how God has helped them.
Interesting.
And I thought, well, I've always believed in God, but you know, where is he? He doesn't help me, et cetera, et cetera. And it kept on happening, you know, to the extent that I was isolated and people were visiting me. I had people cooking food for me, people inviting me places, and that began to get rid of the isolation.
Okay.
And you know what I've just realized? I've mixed the stories because there were two things that happened. So when the people started coming to me, that wasn't the point of rage. That was the point of just a deep sadness and something moving to depression where I didn't care anymore. And then I thought I would just go out and be a drug dealer and stuff and hopefully die. That was kind of like I'd resigned in life.
Okay.
Then I met all these people and I started to feel included, right?
Okay, yeah.
And I started to see things improve. And what happened is I actually started hanging out with some of them. I went to church. I got involved in sort of programs and I was learning more about God, etc. And I saw differences, you know, I saw my life begin to improve and I was like, okay, this is okay. Then I basically went through the first year with a new group of friends and no, they weren't like how I used to be, but they were okay. You know, what I found out is I was opening myself up to meet new people who were different from me. Yeah. And it was new. So all of that was going well until the last week of university, the last 2 or 3 days. And then I was supposed to go to an event called Cafe Church with some of the new people I'd met, right? And on that day, everyone, like nobody was going. Everyone had another agenda. And then for some reason, I was just back in that place and I felt that isolation again. And that moment is when the rage came. And I remember it. Why?
Okay.
The reason the rage came is because prior my first term, I obviously said, I'm going to drop out. I'm just going to enjoy uni, mess about, go to raves, try and be with as many girls as possible, all of this, right? And then I was like, I met a group of people who told me about God and that my life will get better. And I have noticed things get better, but they told me all these amazing stories. I haven't got any amazing stories. And on top of that, all the kind of what I call fun stuff in inverted commas that I wanted to do, I haven't now done, but it's the end of my first year. So I just felt as though someone had like pulled the wool over my eyes and everything I planned to do, I wasn't able to do, but I've missed the opportunity. So that's why the deep sense of rage and stuff came. And I thought, how on earth did I even let that happen? You know, who is God? Where is God? Etc. And I just went into one, right? And then on that particular day, that's when I just thought, now I'm just going to be a crazy person. You know, I'm just going to do something and end up prison or dead, right? And then on that day, a number of things began to happen, which I'll call as supernatural, right? And I won't necessarily go into details because that might be quite long, unless you want to know some specific details, ask me. But a number of things started to happen. And it culminated, like, at the end of a number of hours, probably about 4 hours after this, I ended up with probably 15 to 20 people in my room, in my bedroom, and it was spontaneous. And it was just a spontaneous social event, right? And what that means in the kind of week of uni is having 15 to 20 people are going to be phoning them, right? Because, you know, people are going to want to know where some people are. So that was happening. And, you know, it started with like 3 people and then it turned to 20 because people were literally phoning people and then they're like, oh, I'm at Jeffrey's room. So it came. And then something happened where somebody received one of those calls. But at this time, he was playing PlayStation. And when he received the call, he didn't really pay attention. So he was just like, yeah, bye, and hung up. And then 2 girls came to my room, whom I later found out didn't come to my university. And when those 2 girls came to the room, they came because they were looking for someone who wasn't there. But the person who they called said he was there, if that makes sense.
Okay. Right, the guy who wasn't paying attention.
Yeah. So they've turned up to my room by accident. And it was 2 girls and a guy, and the guy goes to the uni. So the guy's now come with these 2 girls that don't go to the uni. And as he's seen so many other guys, there was only 20 guys, by the way. We were all guys in the room. Right, as he's seen so many guys just kind of having pizza, talking, playing, he wants to stay. So he's like, can these girls stay? I'm like, why not? And everyone leaves. And the guy, we were in my room, but it was my friend's PlayStation. So he's wrapping up his stuff, packing up, right? And then everyone leaves. It's just me and him. Then the 2 girls come back. Then they just say, oh, we're not actually from here, but we just wanted to know, is anything happening in these next couple of days? And I said, oh, well, there's a barbecue tomorrow. And so, you know, like, I can invite you to my friend's barbecue. And we exchanged numbers. Then one of the girls saw all the pizza boxes in my room. So she's like, oh, these guys are so messy. They just picked up all the pizza boxes. Like, they just left all the pizza boxes. So she goes to take it to the bin, right? And I show her where the bin is. Then the 4 of us just end up talking. So me and my friend and these 2 girls. And the conversation turns to about God. And what then happens is all my neighbors start coming home, and then there's about, because it's like 3, 4 a.m., then there's a lot of us speaking about God now. And for the first time, there was one particular girl, she was speaking about God in a way that I've never heard before. And everyone's just kind of listening to her. Then one of the guys kind of goes red-faced and starts like panicking. He's just saying, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And then the story about that was, he said something along the lines of his parents just sat him down on the weekend and said they were quite concerned about him because, you know, they've been praying that he kind of pays more attention to God, let's say, and he seems to be going a bit wayward. And they've been saying, they've been praying that an angel comes to speak to him. And he's like, oh my God, I think you're that angel. So he just leaves. And then a few people start to leave after that. And then long story short, I ended up, some circumstances happened where one of the girl who was talking about God was basically left stranded. And then I said to her, and I didn't even properly know her name at the time, yeah? So sorry. So that evening ends. It's the next evening. I take her to a barbecue and she ends up stranded, like in the evening. So I've spent the whole day with a girl I just met, and I take her to the barbecue, and then partly when we're not at the barbecue and stuff, we're talking about God and I'm just asking more questions. She ends up stranded, then she sleeps in my room. Yeah, so I give her the bed, I sleep on the floor. And then, you know, we're just talking more about God, I'm asking questions, etc. Then we part ways. About 3 weeks afterwards, and I never spoke to her again, 3 weeks afterwards, she says, can you call me when you get a chance? Obviously, because I just spent a couple of days with her, we've got each other's numbers. So I call her, and then she tells me about a dream she's had about me. And in the dream, I basically told her about my whole life in the dream. And I told her stuff in the dream, which I had never said to anyone before. So I was like, how did you know all of this information about me? And how can you tell me all these things about my life? And she basically said, God told me. And I was like, what do you mean? And she's like, you know, God speaks to me. And I was like, that's not possible. Like, firstly, I'm not sure if there is a God. How can he speak to you? And she just kind of said that. So obviously that was just a very weird moment for me. And then it happened 2 or 3 more times. So she would either have dreams about me, or she would say she's been praying and she feels God's given a message. And each and every time she called me, it was like the perfect timing. And because these things started to happen, I thought, okay, let me look into this. So on one occasion, I was reading the Bible and I stopped and then I just prayed. And then as I prayed, I asked God a question and then I said, amen. As soon as I said, amen, my phone was ringing and she was the one calling me. Then she said to me, where's your Bible? And I said, oh, it's actually just in front of me. You know, guess what? I was giving it a read, you know, trying to find out more about this God you keep talking about. She says, turn to this scripture. So I turned to the scripture and she said, read it. I read it and she said, I just heard God say, I should tell you that scripture. And then I realized that the prayer that I prayed, and I literally just said amen to, this scripture was like an answer to that prayer. So that blew my mind because I was like, I haven't even had a second to process this. And I said, when did God tell you to call me? She said, I was just sitting down and I heard, call Jeffrey and give him the scripture. All I have to say, Seven, is by then I was sold. I was like, something's going on in this world, because this girl who is basically my age knows all this stuff about me, which is impossible for her to know. We don't even have mutual connections, and she's kept on doing it. This is like the third or the fourth time, through dreams or her telling me God has just told her. And she said to me, God has his eyes on you. He has a purpose for you and he's calling you. So I would say that was my calling in life. And that's when my life really began to change.
Started to shift. And there's two things there that really stand out to me. Number one, something that kind of, I think, relates to everyone. Or two things, actually. Both of them relate to everyone, regardless of kind of your beliefs and background and things like that. Is like, we all have these times where something in the world seems to shift to almost speak to us to help us. And regardless of, I think, where you kind of believe it comes from, there's definitely this energy that's a lot deeper than just what we perceive as human beings, right? 100. Something that's a lot deeper than what we're capable, right? We're not capable of fully understanding the power of the world around us and the energy and the fact that we're all connected, but we are all so deeply connected as a part of the world. Yeah. And I find that such incredible change seems to start to happen when we learn to listen to what those signals are from the world. And sometimes there are things that really stick out that can make you believe in a certain thing. So with you, like, certain really specific things happened that allowed you to believe and find the answers that you needed. Mm. And sometimes it's things that are a lot more subtle, but it maybe steers you away from a certain path. Or to me, like, kind of listening to you, even your whole journey growing up, there were lots of, like, near scrapes, almost things that could have gone a mm-hmm. lot worse if it had just gone slightly more left. But it's almost like this wasn't what the world wanted for you. This wasn't where the energy in your life was going. So you were able to almost narrowly avoid it. And in looking back on it, it's like it kept happening. It happened a lot to you, right? Yeah, so clearly that's not where your energy was going to be going. Clearly the world was trying to steer you in a different direction. And then eventually it reached a head where something sparked. And the kind of the second thing that comes from that is what sparked, right? And to me, it sounds very similar, if not the same, to this idea of purpose, right? I think purpose mm-hmm. is a word that's being thrown around a lot more now, maybe sometimes without being fully mm-hmm. understood. But we get mm-hmm. the luxury, in a way, as human beings, of being able to consciously find a purpose, find a reason to be, and a place to direct our energy. And I think that's a really that's a gift, in a way. That's something we are really lucky to have as human beings. But often we get into these little cycles of kind of not listening to it. And as a result, we spend a lot of time not living in our purpose, and unfortunately some people never find it. And I think that's really relevant to, especially to young leaders who might be listening to this, is like, as a leader, you're probably someone who, and jump in here if you've got anything to add to this, as a leader, you're probably someone who needs to take a stand. I mean, you will need to take a stand as a leader, but you're probably someone who is doing that because you have a good reason to, because you believe in something, or because you've decided mm-hmm. you have a certain calling or certain ability mm-hmm. that you want to use and to give to the world. Like, leaning into that seems to be such a powerful, almost agent for change. You become an agent for change when you're able to lean into that, you know?
100%, Seven. I mean, the way you articulate these concepts is amazing. I mean, bloody hell. I mean, it's fantastic. And
thank you.
Look, from a personal point of view, discovering my purpose shifted and changed my life totally.
Mm.
Every single aspect or facet of my life has changed and shifted because of understanding and discovering my purpose.
Mm. One of the questions I had for you, which I think is a specific point within what you've just said, right, is why did you get into conflict resolution, right? So you mentioned at the beginning some of the stuff you do now in your career, and a chunk of it is to do with conflict resolution. And I'm really interested to know how much you think your story growing up and now this purpose that you've discussed with us and the things you learned in finding that led to you kind of deciding, this is something I'm able to do, this is something I'm good at, or that I want to do as well.
So that's an interesting question, Seven. And I hope you don't mind me shifting the answer a bit. Mm. Because the conflict resolution came about as a good addition to what I do. Okay. You know, the key question is, why did I become a coach?
Okay.
And that's where I strongly believe the calling came from. Or calling came. And, you know, when I turned my life around and I discovered my purpose, my world changed. From believing that the best I could be was a bus driver, I literally remember looking up into the sky and thinking to myself, I can do anything I want to do, and believing it in my heart of hearts. Then I asked myself the question, what do you want to do? And I thought to myself, there are so many people like me. I never knew it before, but there are so many people like me who are living a life they don't want to be living because they don't feel there's any other way. Yeah. So I set out on a path to do that, right? And, you know, my CV and my job experience speaks to the work I've done. Now, what happened in that process as it built is I was working with people in gangs, involved in knife crime, serious youth violence, etc. And I was helping them to change their life. And I was really, really good at it. And I just knew I needed a bigger challenge. Like, I was like, this work I'm doing is amazing. I'm still in touch with some of those people now. They're living very positive lives, but I knew I needed a bigger challenge. And then I just felt God say to me, he's calling me to go to prison. And I felt that within myself, right? I stayed in touch with the girl that I told you about, that had all the dreams about me. On one random occasion, again, she calls me and this time tells me her mum, who's never seen me before, had a dream about me, described me, apparently was pretty accurate, and said she saw me speaking to people in prison. So for me, that was just a confirmation. Okay. I felt as though I was being called, and then someone I've never even met before has had a dream that that's what I'm doing. So the next question was how? And then I felt as though all the work I was doing in the community, I could relate to the young people because, you know, some similar circumstances. However, I have never been into prison as someone to serve time. So I felt as though I couldn't relate the same way in my experience. Then around that time, I received coaching because I was on an internship and my line manager coached me, and I was blown away by the content and what came out from inside of me. And then that's when I knew that what I need to be effective in prison is to become a coach. So I set off on that journey to become a coach so I could work with young people in prison, which is what I started doing back then and I still do now.
So something I want to touch on, if we almost to put something into perspective, take a little bit of a step back to the kinds of things you felt when you were in that state that was a lot, that we'd call a lot worse, right? The anger, the isolation. What do you think your mental health was like at that time? Like, we've kind of discussed bits and pieces, but if you had to summarize, like, what was your mental health, your mental state like at the time, the quality of your well-being? Like, would you say you had things like depression or anything else? And what do you think? And then that's part one of the question. And then what I'm really trying to get at is, what did that change to? So if the things you experienced before, what did your mental health then change to being? Was it lighter? Was it freer? Was it joy? Was it happiness? Right. So what was the transformation there?
Yeah, I would describe it as depression, but, you know, I study psychology, so I say mild depression, the type of depression that if I went and spoke to someone, they probably would give me medication, but not clinical depression. Okay. And I've almost been in that state before in another episode of my life, right? And I didn't get there. But I see clinical depression as something that almost takes the life out of you. And you're in a state for so long that it's just a different way of being. And, you know, you can't necessarily eat. And, you know, people experience it differently. But I see that as deep. I think for me, it was a milder form of depression where I just felt a lot of hopelessness, meaninglessness, powerlessness. A lot of but, you know, hopeless, meaning, powerless, and just no way out. And all of that just shifted 180, totally the other side of the spectrum, where there was energy, where there was purpose. You know, sometimes I tell people particular stories and they highlight to me challenges I have and I don't even see them. And that's one of the things people sometimes, you know, people who know me well, know some of the challenges I've had in life. And sometimes they say you're resilient and et cetera, et cetera. And it's, I don't even see them anymore because I'm so focused. Yeah. I'm paying attention. And sometimes when you're on your way somewhere that you know is important to get to, an obstacle is just something you need to get around. It's never a block. But when I was in that mindset and state, things were blocked. There was no way through or around. Now, challenges don't do that to me. Like, my mindset is different. It's clearer.
It's clearer. Yeah. I think from a philosophical point of view, the way I think that would be described is as awakeness, right? So there was a level of blindness, of this kind of fogginess right in front of your eyes. And then things started to become more clear, both internally and externally. And so it sounded like there was a bit more awakeness. You felt a little bit more awake. And over time, that's kind of increased. And you've gotten energy from that. And you've used that energy to put that energy out into the world. And often what the world does when we put a certain type of energy out into it is it gives us that energy back. So you went from this kind of negative cycle in a way to this positive cycle. You transmuted it into this positive cycle. And that's what I love about kind of your story, is once you started to realize these things, you acted on them, and then you listened, and then you acted, and you listened, and you acted. And I think it's a beautiful transformation, you know? One of the questions I had for you, particularly as we're kind of speaking to younger audiences in this show especially, is now that you've kind of using this and through this transformation, you've done a lot of work with young people, what have you noticed are kind of the most prevalent issues within the younger people that you work with? Because you work with all kind of now, especially now you're an executive coach as well. So you're working with lots of different people from lots of different age ranges. But when you do work with young people, what are the issues that you notice most often, especially to do with things like their mental health, maybe their purpose, and the things that we've talked about today?
Yeah. And you know what? It's very similar to the things we've spoken about, Seven, in terms of what we've gone through. And, you know, depression is big, and so is anxiety. And I think mental health is something I've spoken about a lot more now, which wasn't like that when I was growing up. And I'm not even that much older than you, but it just, you know, it's more something that's, I'm a millennial, you're Gen Z. And I think Gen Zs, you know, talk a lot more about depression and anxiety. And, you know, those things, depending on the severity, can be overcome, right? Those things can be overcome. And what a lot of young people don't see that I feel I kind of come across is they let it define them. And, you know, that's something I always encourage against, as in, I understand those things will happen and those things can be overcome. Mm. Something that's more difficult to overcome is trauma. And when I work with young people with trauma, you know, I support them to get the interventions they need, because that's a bit deeper, and trauma can lead to anxiety and depression as well. But generally, you know, the circumstances in life that happen will kind of lead us to bend to the side of depression and anxiety, and it doesn't have to be that way.
Yeah, I would definitely concur with that, because I've gotten a lot more used to how should I say, like, not just blindly accepting when someone says that they are something, like they are the way they feel. Mm-hmm. So there's a difference between I feel a certain thing and I am a certain thing. And I think I used to, how should I say this? I used to be very accepting when people say I am depressed or I am someone who has anxiety. And I think you're right to say depression and anxiety are probably the two most common for Gen Z. At least it feels that way. I haven't done any recent kind of research into it, but it definitely feels that way from experience in all sorts of areas. And what I would say is, there will be times when it will be a part, like, will it will be very deep or come from some trauma, like you said. But there are times when I think we attach ourselves to it very closely. Almost we get used to saying, I'm like this because I'm depressed. I'm like this because I'm anxious, or even that I have anxiety and that I have depression. And actually, like, as someone who suffered from very intense anxiety and who suffered from very intense depression, there are things, habits, lifestyles, perspectives you can have and build that make it a lot better. You don't need to be too attached to it. Now, it's different if you've been, you made the distinction between like clinical depression and more mild depression. And if that's your case, that's different. But I would, I think what's important to me about your story is like, sometimes even the worst situations can be overcome, and sometimes those situations are mental. So with you, there was very much an external situation causing you to feel and experience certain things. But sometimes those situations go away and it's almost like they're still there. I think a lot of us carry those things with us internally instead of learning how to start, at least start to overcome them. And that's what worries me about my peers and my generation sometimes, you know? But as the reason I want us to give that message is because as leaders, that is something to recognize. When someone has a certain issue, being empathetic with it and then being able to help them through it in the right way is incredibly important to me personally. And I'm willing to bet it is for you too, you know?
Listen, 100%. 100%. And even though I spoke about trauma, one of the things I've learned is nothing defines. So look, Seven, I've spoken about my work with young people, but I've worked with so many people. And yes, I work with executives and leaders now, right? But I've also worked with high risk offenders. And I mean, I mean adult high risk offenders, so not young people. And when I say high risk, I mean, there's a category called MAPA. And I've worked with the highest level. So the worst types of offense you can think of, I've done it. Just those type. And I've learned a lot from working with them too, particularly around depression and anxiety and things like that. And the things that lead and mess people's lives up. And I understand you can come through anything you go through. It doesn't feel like it at the time, but one of the amazing things about humans is our ability to persevere. And we don't know how much we can persevere until we're tested. That's one of the things. Nobody knows their perseverance or their resilience level until the situation comes. However, going through a situation where I later found out it was traumatic as well. So I didn't know, but I even used to have physical reactions where certain things would come to mind, right? What I read a book to help me, and the book gave an analogy of three elements: coffee, an egg in its shell, and a carrot. And it said, when the pressures in life come, imagine that's boiling water. Which of those three elements do you want to be? Well, if you're the egg and you get boiled from the pressure of life, you become hard. And that reminds me of the murderers and the terrorists that I've worked with. And then other things happen that you might be the carrot. And when you boil a carrot, it becomes soft, right? And that reminds me of the people that I know who use drugs and alcohol to escape from their problems.
Okay.
And then there's the coffee bean, which a coffee bean in and of itself is probably useless. But when the water comes on it, the pressure comes on it, not only does it smell good to some people, not me, it tastes good.
Yeah.
And the coffee bean, when water comes, becomes more useful because of the pressure than it was in the beginning.
Yeah.
Listen, you see that analogy? It changed my life for one reason.
Interesting.
I realized you choose which element you want to be.
Yeah.
In any given situation, in anything that happens moment by moment, choice by choice, you can choose. And when stuff hits the fan for me, as it still does now, right? I ask myself the question, which actions or choices will make me hard? I'm not going to take that. Which will make me soft? I'm not going to take that. Which will make me better? And I go for that. Listen, I've articulated it, right?
Oh, that hits me. That hits me. That I felt that in my spine.
Listen, and look, as I'm speaking to you, I'm getting goosebumps because life is not rosy. It has its good moments, but life can happen to you too. Like sometimes things out of your control will come and sweep the rug from under you. Life will happen to people and things they never even believed possible for them will happen to them. And sometimes people think life is over. And because of all the different groups and people that I've worked with, I know that it can be. I've literally seen some people's lives over. They're walking, but they're dead.
And yeah, there's zombies.
And there are other people. I count myself as one of them, where some stuff has happened to me, and I chose coffee as much as I could. Sometimes I might have made a decision or choice I shouldn't have, but as much as I could, I chose coffee, and it was damn hard. Some of the hardest things I've done in my life. But then I learned a lesson, right? And 50 Cent said it in his song, Many Men. Sunny days wouldn't be special if it wasn't for rain, and joy wouldn't feel so good if it wasn't for pain. And some of the things that have happened in my life, which I thought came to destroy me, and they 100% could have destroyed me, have worked out better for me and enabled and caused me to be who I am today. They've worked out intrinsically in the character that I've built, and extrinsically in the way my life looks, and even the things that I have and the relationships around me. So I know, and the message I want to communicate as clearly as possible, that irrespective of what anybody goes through, including you and I, Seven, we have choices, and we can choose to be a carrot, an egg, or a coffee bean. And as hard as it is, always choose to be a coffee bean, even when you don't know what the outcome would be. So many times in my life, I've made choices that I think and I know to be the right choice, but I can't even say I'm confident it will have a good outcome. And what most people say is, what's the point? I didn't know the point either. I just said, I've got a choice to make. I'm going to make the good one. And things happen over time. And decisions that you make in the past, if they're good ones, come back to support you in the future.
Yeah, it's the whole idea that the energy you give is the energy that gets given back to you. And that, I think, is as a note to kind of wrap things up, is such a beautiful one, because no matter what you are in, the state you are in, what life has thrown at you, you do get a choice. You know, when you describe people who, you know, you can see that they're like zombies now, that, you know, like the life is out of them completely. To me, that is a state that scares me, because I think a lot of people get there without even realizing it. And they have moments of what you've described of awakeness, and then things get worse again, they get unconscious about it again. And actually, you always have a choice. I think that is such a beautiful place to leave us, man.
Before you wrap up, Seven, I just remembered that on New Year's Day 2021, I did an interview with National Prison Radio, and I read a poem for the guys. And I'd like to share that poem with your listeners today and end on that.
Yeah, please do. Please do.
So this poem is called Don't Quit. And I think it's by a guy called John Greenleaf Whittier. Apologies if that's not true. But anyway, the poem's called Don't Quit. When things go wrong, as they sometimes will, when the road you're trudging seems all uphill, when the funds are low and the debts are high, and when you want to smile, but you have to sigh, when care is pressing you down a bit, rest if you must, but don't you quit. Life is strange with its twists and turns, as every one of us sometimes learns, and many failures come about when he might have won had he stuck it out. Don't give it up, though the pace seems slow, you may succeed with another blow. Success is failure turned inside out, the silver tint of the clouds of doubt. And you never can tell just how close you are. It may be near when it seems so far. So stick to the fight when your hardest hit. It's when things seem worse that you must not quit.
Wow. I love that. Thank you so much for that, Jeffrey. Where can people find you, learn more about you, and anything else like that?
Yeah, people can connect with me on LinkedIn. So Jeffrey Wotherspoon on LinkedIn, and also just my website, jeffreywotherspoon.com. And yeah, please reach out to me. Happy to speak.
Cool. Thank you so much for that, man. This has been an incredible one, a humbling one, and I've loved every second of it. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Seven. It's been great speaking to you, as always.
All right, thank you so much for tuning in, everyone. Sharing our stories like this, I'm sure you can imagine, can be difficult, especially with some of the challenges that we discussed today, right? But we find it so important for leaders, and especially young leaders, to know that they are not alone in experiencing mental health challenges. Now, as a final reminder before we close, that across this season, I'm running a survey and giveaway. All you need to do is check the description below. It really helps me out. And if you can, I'd also love for you to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Thank you so much for being here and for helping out. It genuinely means so much to me. I have been Seven. This has been Lost and Searching, and we will be back very soon.